Oh, okay. All right, perfect.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thanks to everyone that's here. We have four bills that are scheduled for public hearing and work session. I'm giving notice that we will not be having work sessions on those four bills for various reasons. Either amendments or paperwork is not available and ready for action today. But we will be taking testimony on each of these and get the public hearings taken care of, and then we'll reschedule the work sessions as we get the amendments and or paperwork in. So my understanding, we have Senator Olson here, so we're going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 493.
That's 323.
Oh, excuse me, 323. Thank you very much. So we're opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 323.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 323 was brought to us by Senator Olson. It expands the crime of arson in the first degree and second degree to include causing a fire or explosion as a result of knowingly manufacturing a controlled substance. Current law only applies to the manufacture of methamphetamine. There are no amendments, and the fiscal or revenue statements are not yet ready.
All right. Thank you. And Senator Olson, before you get started, just to put on the record, there was a discussion on Tuesday night in the, I'm not sure what we're calling it, the Measure 91 or Marijuana Committee that talked about another provision that's in one of the bills that we have before that committee regarding having a modification and claim and for a arson charge where someone has created a fire as they were illegally processing marijuana extracts. So you'll be hearing some additional testimony tonight or today regarding what was discussed then. I just wanted to put that on the record because there are some issues, potential issues as to parity between the punishments that would be called for under Senate Bill 323 and the provisions in this other bill. So we'll put that on the record. We'll take your testimony. Then I didn't want that to be a surprise having people come up after you and then making the statements they're going to make. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 323. I first gave consideration to this legislation when I read several stories making hash oil and the resulting fires that were caused by that production of the hash oil. Research indicated that Senate Bill 302, Section 9, which you just referred to, I believe, Mr. Chair, covered any fires caused by manufacturing of a cannabinoid extract. And it's clearly in the bill on page 7, Section 9. My intent was not to obfuscate this section or this bill, but to add to a bill that already existed, and that was Senate Bill, or I should say, I'm sorry, Oregon Revised Statute 164.315 and 164.325. These existing laws pertain to the manufacture of methamphetamine. When you cause a fire, if you're making methamphetamine, it's considered an arson. The problem with the bill with that particular, those two particular laws, I should say, are that if you are an attorney and someone is perhaps cooking heroin and a fire starts, this law doesn't cover it because it only deals with methamphetamine. So what my proposal in Senate Bill 323 is that we remove the term methamphetamine and we replace it with a controlled substance. And a controlled substance and manufacturer are defined by Oregon Revised Statute 475.005. So basically what I'm asking for is that we cover all bad drugs that people use, and if they're doing something illegally with those bad drugs and they cause a fire, then they should be held liable for the damage they do. And we actually have two sections. If it's less than a particular dollar volume, it's one felony, and if it's more, then it's a larger felony. The City of Portland prepared an information piece recognizing and responding to illegal drug activity. And in this piece, under a heading, Illegal Drug Activity Affects Us All, they state, and I quote, some of the impacts include damage to property from neglect, contamination, fires, explosions, and theft of services such as electricity and water. The City of Portland recognizes the problem, and Senate Bill 323 is legislation to hold those that commit these crimes accountable. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I will take any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for Senator Olson. Senator Denbro.
I do have a question, and I don't know that Senator Olson's the one to answer it, but, you know, when I think of arson, I think of something that's deliberate. I suppose, you know, statutorily that may not be the case, but, you know, I imagine a situation where someone, you know, a heroin addict, for example, is, you know, melting the product and, you know, through negligence or, you know, whatever, something might hit something flammable and a fire starts. But that doesn't seem like arson to me, as I think of arson. So I just wonder what how you'd respond to that.
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. Senator Denbro, in the bill, Senate Bill 302, which is, as I just mentioned, Section 9, it says a person commits the crime of arson incident to manufacture of cannabinoid extract. So in other words, if they're trying to make hash oil and they burn the place down, you would consider that arson. But under the terms of Senate Bill 323, when we talk of a controlled substance, we talk of any illegal drug that's identified by the federal government as a Schedule 1 through Schedule 4 drug. Now, you mentioned the fact that if someone turns over their cooking operation, is that necessarily arson? Well, manufacture, by the definition in our Oregon revised statutes, means the production, preparation, propagation, compounding, conversion, or processing of a controlled substance. So if you're preparing heroin to inject, that would fall under the category of manufacture by our own laws. So yes, it would not be. If you look at it technically, was that an arson-caused event? Did you want to do that? Well, most people don't want their hash factories to blow up. Most people that are manufacturing drugs don't want it to blow up. But if you are doing something illegal as defined by our laws and preparation is defined in our laws, if you're preparing your needle to take an injection, which is sad that it happens, and the fire starts and people could get hurt, buildings could get burned down, and you put our firemen and our policemen in jeopardy when you do things like this. So the purpose of the law was to clarify 164.315, 164.325, because it dealt with only methamphetamine. And so I've changed it to a controlled substance.
Other questions? Senator Lithicum first, and then Senator Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The phrase controlled substance, I did a cross-reference and found the definition in ORS 475.05, which refers to federal controlled substance acts with regard to marijuana. Is there, you know, in federal jurisdiction versus state jurisdiction, how does that mix into this controlled substance?
Well, not being a lawyer, I would just, on common sense and assumption, since we have passed legalization of marijuana, I believe our laws in that particular event would take precedent over the federal law.
Let me give some explanation on that. There is the federal schedule, and most states follow, just adopt the federal schedule as their own schedule. But the state does have the authority, and we do, in fact, have our own schedule. But we have, in fact, adopted, and I'll have certified smart people coming in and correcting me if I'm wrong on this, that have, in fact, adopted what is in the federal schedule, with the exception of cannabis or marijuana. In 2009, there was a bill that we passed out of the legislature in recognition of the medical marijuana program in the state being in effect for 10 years, and we modified it from being a Schedule 1 drug to a Schedule 2 drug. So that's the only difference I know that's between the federal schedule and the state schedule, but that was done back in 2009 in recognition of the citizens of this state passing medical marijuana in 1998 and going into effect in 1999.
Just to follow on, the definition here, means a drug, et cetera, refers to the Federal Controlled Substance Act 21 U.S.C. 811-812, and then there's a subsection. This does not mean hemp as defined, but there is no subsection with regard to marijuana, just for information's sake.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Linthicum, also in on the controlled substance, when we talk about Schedule 1 through 5 under the Federal Controlled Substance Act, as you just mentioned, 21 U.S.C. 811-812, it also states as modified under ORS 475.035. Okay. So that kind of eliminated the marijuana side of it, I believe.
Thank you for that clarification.
All right, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. And maybe I would have my, I'm looking up 475005, controlled substance definition. So what I was, and I hadn't had a chance to read it yet quite. It takes a while to look it up. But I wish they would have hyperlinks in the bills.
We'll see if there's any other questions.
But, yeah. But as you mentioned compounding, and I'm thinking of compounding pharmacies, and I don't know, but would this include pharmacies, and would sometimes they might have to deal with controlled substances?
I do not believe it deals with that because they are licensed to handle controlled substances. I might be wrong, but, and when we look at 323, relating to arson caused by the manufacturer of a controlled substance, and relating to clause, and what the original bill said that by knowingly engaging in the manufacture of methamphetamine, the person causes fire or causes an explosion that damages property. A pharmacist is a licensed retailer that is controlled by the federal government. These are illicit drugs, illegal drugs. Going back, if I may, Mr. Chair, 2 years past when we used to deal with LSD and hallucinogens and things like that, many of those drugs were prepared with flame, and this would kind of go back to that situation. If you're doing something with an illegal controlled substance and you burn a building down, I feel that, you have, A or one, broken the law by having the illegal controlled substance, and B or two, you've done further damage by burning a building down. I think this bill just clarifies our consistent and clarification of the statutes we already have on the books, which is 164.315 and 164.325, by just removing methamphetamine and putting in controlled substance.
All right, I'm going to have Whitney go over some explanations. I guess the other part, if you could also address the issue that's come up from Senator Thatcher, if you weren't going to, as to does the bill have a distinction between someone who is licensed to actually perform these type of works as part of their businesses, or would it be something that we'd really want to look at to make certain that we wouldn't have unintended consequences?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher. If you notice on Senate Bill 323, in addition to referring to 475.005 to define controlled substance, it also has that to define manufacture. And so for the definition of manufacture that it is referring to, it has an exception. It ends by saying it does not include the preparation or compounding of a controlled substance by a practitioner as an incident to administering or dispensing of a controlled substance in the course of a professional practice, or by a practitioner or authorized agent under the practitioner's supervision for the purpose or incident to research, teaching, or chemical analysis, and not for sale. So I think that would exclude your concern for pharmacists.
So basically, just for the record, it's based on the definition of manufacture, which we would be linking back to, does have the provisions to give the safeguards for those who are licensed or authorized to do so under law.
Which ORS was it?
That was the 475.005.
And then underneath that, you have the different terms.
Right. Yeah. Subsection 15.
I see it, subsection. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for the Senator? Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, so we have, at this point, two individuals. I say this point because I know 8 o'clock's early for some people to get signed up, but we do have Gail Meyer and Rob Bovette. If you two would like to come up, and is there anyone else who would like to be giving testimony on Senate Bill 323? And whoever would like to start, I've got Gail as a against unless amended, and then I've got Rob with kind of a line on the
line.
Neutral. Not sure ups or downs, just.
And I'll try to explain. Chair Przanski, a member of the committee for the record, Rob Ovad, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. So in isolation, we would probably be in favor of this bill, and I'll explain why. But there's another bill out there that I'll try to explain as briefly as I can. It's Senate Bill 302, together with Senate Bill 303, comprises a very large package we've been working on for about 2 years to completely rewrite the marijuana offense code. It is a monster bill. A lot of stakeholders have been involved. And one of the things it does is it addresses this issue square on, but it's more focused and targeted. One of the things that this bill does, actually the primary thing that Senate Bill 302 does, is it removes cannabis entirely from the Controlled Substances Act and the state law, because we needed to do that to clean up all kinds of other problems and Band-Aids that we've been patching on. So this bill actually would not work together with 302, would be in direct conflict. You may recall, Senator Przanski, that in 2005 you actually helped me craft a bill that added meth labs to Arson 1 and Arson 2. In 302, what we wanted to do was do basically the same thing, roughly the same thing, because also in 302 we are eliminating entirely the crime of manufacture within 1,000 feet of a school, which is a broad spectrum crime that covers a lot of people and covers this. We wanted to target in on BHO labs. And I guess I should pause and talk about the problem. It is a growing problem in Oregon. We are having a fairly exponential increase in people manufacturing at home cannabis extracts using a particular process that's commonly known as BHO, butane hash oil or butane honey oil. It's not the only way to make a concentrate or an extract, but it's the one that generally tends to catch fire and blow up. And we are seeing dozens and dozens of these each year, and we're trying to collect the data. But it seems to be growing, much to our chagrin, because people can now buy BHO, at retail. And so we're trying to make this product more available in a safe manner. So it's a real struggle and a real challenge for law enforcement right now. But that's basically what we've crafted in 302. We did not add it to the Arson 1 statute because that has some Measure 11 implications we were trying to avoid. So we created it own separate mere parallel statute to essentially do what we've done with meth labs, with BHO labs in the context of that legislation. We would generally be in support of amending this bill to make it consistent with 302, but I think we're going to take care of the issue here in 302. So that's my brief. I can get into the nuts and bolts if you want, but that's my brief explanation of why you see that squiggly line there. Like the bill, it's great, but we've created a package that kind of takes care of it in a different way.
All right. Thank you. Gail, why don't you give us your testimony, and then we'll do questions.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. There's aspects of 303 and 302 that we both like, and in an ideal world to us, we'd kind of blend them. Here's our bottom line concern with respect to 323. If you go on Section 2 of 323, it amends the crime of arson in the first degree by expanding the definition of methamphetamine to mean all of controlled substances. Our concern is Arson 1 under ORS 164.325 is a Measure 11 offense, and that carries with it a mandatory 90 months prison sanction. We're always very averse to expanding a Measure 11 crime if we can avoid it at all. So in the context of the negotiated package deal that we've been discussing with Mr. Bovet and other stakeholders on the cannabis side, in Senate Bill 302, what we really appreciated was they simply created their own Class A felony. They just called it a different crime, and it didn't incorporate the ORS number that's in Measure 11. So that's what we prefer about 302. It doesn't expand a Measure 11 offense. What we like about 323 is that it does acknowledge a stair step between Arson 2 and Arson 1. So Arson 2 would be a C felony, depending on the kind of property you're talking about. Arson 1 would be an A felony, again, depending on the kind of property you're talking about. So I don't know. I just discussed this with Mr. Bovet. We would like to see that stair step between a C felony and an A felony incorporated into 302. But the bottom line concern for OCDLA is, please let's not expand Measure 11. We would prefer not to see those mandatory minimums apply beyond where they already are.
All right. Thank you. Questions for either? Thanks for the explanation. Thanks for the testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I'll ask if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 323. Not seeing anyone coming up. Close the public hearing. And now we're going to go down to
Josh's there.
Yeah, 507.
Yes, 507.
So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 507. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 507 clarifies the general rule that a conviction for a Class C felony may be set aside by the court. We do have the fiscal impact. It has a minimal fiscal impact, but we do not have the revenue impact statement yet.
All right. And Senate Bill 507, we have, looks like, Jeff Lowe and Mary Sell. And while they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 507? So we have support from both individuals. So whoever would like to start?
Oh, after you.
Okay, sounds good. Good morning, Chair Przanski, Madam Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am here to offer support of Senate Bill 507. Essentially, all this bill is doing is taking some clunky language and clarifying it. It's a great fix because it's going to make everything clearer. So 161705 allows Class C felonies to be reduced to Class A misdemeanors. The current language essentially says any felony punishable as a misdemeanor is eligible for expungement. This fix simply lists it out. And so it includes Class C felonies, and it also says Class A misdemeanors. In my private practice, before doing public defense, I did a handful of expungements, and it was a really fun area to do. Our clients got a lot of pleasure out of being able to move forward with their lives after kind of pulling it together and doing good work. I think that this is going to just make it clearer for the courts, and it's going to make it clearer for practitioners. All around, just a really great fix, and so we appreciate your consideration to vote yes on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeff?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee. My name is Jeffrey Lowe, L-O-W-E. I'm a deputy district attorney with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I have been a prosecutor now for 17 years. I am here on behalf of the MCDA as well as the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 507. It is with a little bit of meekness I say to you today that I'm partially responsible for the need for this fix. Alex Bassos from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office and I in 2015 were the authors of the major rewrite to ORS 137.225, the set-aside statute, also commonly and wrongly referred to as the expungement statute. Mm-hmm. As a DA, I have reviewed over 800 expungement requests. I have litigated over 50. This fix is a technical fix. It reintroduces directly back into the statute that C felonies are able to be set aside with exceptions that follow and subsections following it. It is simply a clarification. From what I understand, some judges are misunderstanding. We've caused a little bit of confusion, which I regret and I am sorry about, but then we do our best as lawyers to write good statutes, and even us who are practitioners who actually work in this every day, we sometimes make mistakes. So I'm asking that you do pass this bill. Thank you.
All right, Jeffrey, no apologies necessary. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, and you know from our work, we also think we have it right the first time. Sometimes it takes two or three times to actually get what we need. So questions for the panel. Senator Denborough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So my question is not actually about this bill, but I want to take advantage of your expertise with expungement, if you'll indulge me.
Yeah, we'll see if it's germane enough.
Yeah. I had the opportunity last night to attend a listening session that Multnomah County, the court, has been holding a series of listening sessions in various parts of the county, inviting people to come and talk about their experience with the judicial system. And it was great. It was, you know, I really enjoyed the frankness and, you know, the manner in which people's stories were received. And I think it's a great thing. One fellow talked about his experience with expungement, which has been very frustrating. He committed a crime many years ago, I think 30 years ago. It was theft when he was a teenager or a young adult. And he subsequently had it expunged, but he recently was laid off from his longtime job and was looking for a new job, and they did a background check. And the expungement or some information was available in the criminal background check. And he, trying to get certification that that crime had been expunged, set him into a kind of bureaucratic black hole from which he's yet to emerge, you know. And I'm just wondering if that is a common problem. You know, he was told he needed to have some kind of stamp on the order showing that he'd been expunged, and that wasn't being released to him, and his file no longer existed. And you know, I'm just wondering about this problem, especially now that we're in the age of the internet. Can an expungement ever really protect a person from, you know, from that kind of thing?
I'll address them, then Mr. Bassos, who's walked up here, will also address who's on the defense side. The problem with expungements, set-asides, is that Google and a number of other corporations, they sift through public records. They retain those public records. And the orders of the judges do not get to those private records held by private companies. And so this information may exist on a different server forever, unless something is dealt with that. And I'm not certain what the fix at this point to that would be. The challenge he faces in trying to get certification of something that no longer exists is that it no longer exists. I mean, it does. It's sealed. There's the ability to access it, but by reopening it so that you can make certain that it is what it is and then closing it back up again, you're revealing the very thing that you're trying to hide. And that is the challenge with set-asides and expungements, is that there's only so much that you can do. And I empathize for him, and I'm not certain what the fix for him would be, but perhaps Mr. Bassos. So that's my view. We don't see it as much as perhaps the defense does. They usually come to us last at the DA's office, but it does come up from time to time.
Thank you.
And Alex, are you going to make if you're making a statement, I just need you to put your name on the record.
I'd be happy to, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senator Dembro.
Name first.
Oh, sorry. Alex Bassos.
Thank you.
I am here on behalf of OCDLA and prepared to testify on the expungement bill that is coming up. I am in charge of the community law programs for the Metropolitan Public Defender. I started our expungement clinic about 13 years ago and have been a part of about 13,500 expungement cases. I've also been a part of a number of attempts to rewrite the expungement statute, some successful, some unsuccessful. This issue is really multiple issues that you raise, Senator Dembro, most of which we have attempted to address at one time or another. This particular gentleman, I think I could help. I think it is possible to unseal a record enough to get that paperwork in order to move it to a separate place to establish that someone has actually expunged their case. And that problem actually comes up less than you would think it would. The problem that comes up, though, all the time is that criminal record checks are an important part of our society at this point. Employers, renters, and others rely on them. This is different than the mugshots that simply appear on a Google search that are scraped from public documents. there is a statute on those. But for actual criminal record check companies, this is a valid part of our society. But most of those criminal record check companies operate out of state. And when the expungement statute says that official records shall be sealed, well, that doesn't get to those out-of-state companies. And in fact, there's such a strong free speech clause in Oregon that it makes it very difficult to get at those. In addition, the Fair Credit Reporting Act preempts our attempts to fix that problem, gets in our way there. Suffice it to say that Ms. Myers and I have spent, I don't know, at least 50 or 60 hours trying to track down a fix for this problem that has thus far eluded us. But we would love to keep working with this committee to see if we can't find some solution to it. It is a complicated one, unfortunately.
So since we have the certified smart people here, I'm going to throw another one out there. I also thought that there's also a concern that someone goes in to expunge a conviction if they're not aware their arrest record doesn't get expunged at the same time as the conviction, or am I mistaken on that?
Chair Przanski, when you expunge a conviction, everything that is part of that case gets expunged as well.
Okay.
There are sometimes confusing situations where the case was initially charged under one case number and then it's recharged and the conviction appears under a different case number and we don't catch that and one is still there. There are complicated variations on the theme, but for the most part, we're able to pull in an arrest that goes with a conviction. And we're supposed to be pulling in that other case, even in the hypothetical I identified, but sometimes it doesn't get caught.
So then on the other flip part of this for the record is that if someone is arrested, but they're not actually convicted, they still have to go through that process to take care of the arrest to get that expunged or set aside.
Chair Brzezinski, yes, absolutely.
All right.
There's an affirmative obligation to file a motion and an affidavit anytime you want to set aside anything. Nothing is automatic under the Oregon scheme.
Senator Dimberly, follow up?
Yes, I just want to say, Alex, thank you for your offer of sending information to you, because as you were speaking, I got an email from this individual. I had given him my card last night. And so.
Oh, I thought he was watching us right now.
It's all forwarded on to you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And Jeffrey and Alex, why don't you all just sit here? Because we're going to pick up the next case after that. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 507. We're going to go ahead and open up our next 497. So Senate Bill 497 now is open for public hearing. And is this Michaels?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 497 defines arrest in the context of clarifying what actions can be expunged from an individual's record. It states that arrest means any action that results in the creation of an official record alleging the commission of an offense. We have received the fiscal and revenue statements on the underlying bill. However, we are still working on an amendment that streamlines the set-aside process for victims of mistaken arrest and identity theft.
All right. Thank you. So we'll start with Gail and Alex, whoever or both of you are going to speak on this, and then we'll have Jeffrey's testimony.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer. You're staying here. Oh, okay. On behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, you really do have the two certified smart people here in front of the room. It's great that they were here to engage in that discussion with the committee, because you have a font of knowledge at both ends here. I'll just cue up big picture, and then Mr. Bassos will explain in greater detail. The prior bill we just heard about, Senate Bill 507, discussed what crimes are eligible to be set aside. This bill, 497, sort of cleans up what records can qualify to be set aside. So our current expungement statute expressly talks about records of arrest and records of conviction. There are times, however, when there's a record of some allegation, but the person was never formally arrested. A common example of that is if an officer engages someone in the field, they decide to cite them into court. They don't put cuffs on them. They don't book them. They just give them a ticket, say, come into court later. That individual does come into court later, and there's no charges filed. So the officer at the scene thought, this is a low-risk guy. I don't need to arrest him. Some reviewing DDA looked at the police report, said, I don't even need to file this thing. So the individual's free to go. They've never been formally arrested. But there is a record of that citation. So this bill is intended to address those instances where there's a record of some allegation, but it didn't result in an arrest or a conviction. The problem is, in today's world, with third-party reporting data mining companies, these things can still be reported out there. So we're trying to clean that up. Language matters. These two have been talking, and I think from here I'll let Mr. Bassos take on.
Excuse me. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Alex Bassos. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I run our community law programs for the Metropolitan Public Defender. As such, I handle all of our expungements with students and other attorneys. I started our free expungement clinic about 13 years ago. I've handled approximately 13 or 14,000 expungements in that time. I've also written the guide for OCDLA on expungements. I regularly speak on the subject. I've helped start three other free clinics throughout the state. Not least of which, Mr. Lowe, who's sitting at the table, and I wrote the most recent revision of the expungement statute. For as long as I've been handling expungements, we've known that arrest can't possibly just mean arrest. It wouldn't make sense. A person who was charged with a serious crime, for example, like rape, by the case going directly to the grand jury, and then the defendant sets the case up for an arraignment, is never arrested. But if that case is dismissed, or the person wins at trial, then we have a situation where there's been no arrest, but it clearly falls under the expungement statute, because why would you want to have that person not have their case expungible, where a person who was arrested, taken into custody, sat in jail for a year before they got the case dismissed or went to trial and won, would have their case expungible? Those two situations are exactly the same. Same thing at a different level with violations. Let's say you are charged with possession of less than an ounce of marijuana under the old statute when it was a violation. Now it's been legalized, but for a long time, since the 1970s, it was decriminalized, but still a violation level offense where you could lose your license, receive a fine, have it on your record, and have it stigmatizing you for any employer or renter that you applied to. So in that situation, if you take arrest to actually mean a formal arrest, then if you are convicted, you'll be able to get that thing expunged. But if the case is dismissed because you were falsely accused, then it will be there on your record stigmatizing you for the rest of your life. That these inconsistencies simply don't make sense. So we have always, in all of the time that I've been doing expungements, treated arrest as meaning something like arrest citation or criminal charge. An arrest or a dismissed case is what I usually teach. That's what's in my OCDLA guide and my PowerPoint when I go out and do lectures. This was what everyone was assuming, including LDAs, including when Mr. Lowe and I handled many expungements together. But recently, DAs throughout the state have been objecting, saying, no, arrest means arrest. And I don't think, well, let me say further that in every one of those cases that I've been a part of, the DA has said, we don't have any moral or normative objection to this case being expunged, but we feel like we need to follow the law. It says arrest, and so your person wasn't formally arrested, therefore we need to object. And in a certain amount of cases, the judge is saying, yeah, everyone says arrest, there's no arrest. So it feels to us like this is a technical fix. We're not asking for anything more than what everyone assumed the expungement statute to be for the decade and a half that I was handling expungements before, the last 9 months or so when the objection started. So we would ask this. Oh, I guess one more thing as well, which is Mr. Lowe and the DA's Association had some concerns about our current language, that it would expand what was potentially expungible as a dismissed offense to more than what is currently expungible or what we were treating as expungible. For example, violations of a restraining order, contempt cases. It is not our intent in any way to broaden the statute beyond what we believed it to be for the last decade and a half. And I believe that we have some new language that will more precisely address this issue by amending 137.2251B to simply say, instead of arrest, citation, or criminal charge, and then amending 8B, 2258B, so that it says clearly that traffic infractions or citations wouldn't apply, so we don't pull in or overwhelm the courts with dismissed traffic cases, traffic citations. And I believe that we'll be able to put together some language that will work to do the trick here.
All right, thank you, Jeffrey.
Chair Brzezinski, members of this committee, my name is Jeffrey Lowe, L-O-W-E, from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, as well as on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. Thank you for listening to me today on Senate Bill 497. I do oppose it as it is written, but again, as Mr. Bassos has already stated, we are working on language to amend this. There were really two reasons why I objected to this language and why I think you should be aware of our concerns. The first is the danger that we always have in defining a term in two separate places for two different purposes. We already have in Oregon Revised Statutes a definition of what arrest is, which is at RS 133.005. And that definition of arrest is really what drives the criminal code, search and seizure law, all sorts of things. My concern in creating a new definition is that there will cause some confusion. As you know, legal minds can differ with regards to what words mean. We look for definitions. And when we add a new definition in a separate place, that only gives rise to people arguing about what does this word really, really mean if we have two different definitions. That was my first concern. My second concern with the language as drafted in Senate Bill 497 is that it was unintendedly overbroad. I do empathize with Mr. Bassos's position that there is a hole in our current statute that allows certain types of charges to not be eligible. And again, it's those citation cases where a person was never arrested, but they were given a citation by a police officer. There may have also been a filing by the district attorney at some point on that charge. Ultimately was dismissed. Technically, under the law, they're not eligible. I didn't notice that when I was doing these expungements 2 years ago, but recently, within the last year, I understand that a number of prosecutors across the state, including in Multnomah County, have really looked closely and feel that this is the black-letter law, and we need to follow that as prosecutors. And so, again, I empathize that there is this hole. As a horrid example for you as to the disparity that is created by this exclusion. Several years ago, I handled an expungement hearing with regards to a person that had been acquitted of murder. Under the statute, when you have a charge that's dismissed against you, you become eligible to have that matter set aside, including all the way up to murder. I suppose treason would also qualify. He had waited the 10 years because there were other matters that he had been convicted of, which would make him ineligible for that 10 years. He filed. Of course, I was quite concerned given the seriousness of the crime that he had stood accused but was acquitted of. I objected on different basis that I found. Ultimately, I lost. Ultimately, that murder was set aside and is now sealed. It seems wrong that a person who is acquitted of murder can have that charge set aside, but a person charged with less than an ounce of marijuana can't. That seems to be a bit of a disparity in the law. And so, again, I recognize the intent behind it. My second concern as to why this is not good language, though, is that I feel that it opens up the possibility of other things being set aside that the district attorney's office across the state have fought very hard to make certain they aren't eligible to be set aside. And that's specifically regards to punitive contempt as well as fugitive matters. The most common contempt matter that we handle in our office is violation of restraining order. And as you know, sometimes that's the first time a woman who has faced the abuser is able finally to stand up for herself by filing that restraining order. And then, of course, her abuser violates it. And then a charge, which is a contempt charge, it's not a crime, it's also not a civil matter, it's a contempt charge with the court. Those get filed, and often they get dismissed because the state still needs a witness to testify, and sometimes she's just unwilling to do that. My concern is that in that situation, all of a sudden, this matter would become eligible for a set-aside under the current language in Senate Bill 497. We don't think that's right. We think it's important that these records remain open. The Court of Appeals has stood beside us and said yes over and over in many court cases over the years that contempt matters and violation matters of restraining orders do not qualify under the statute. We want to make certain that remains. My other concern was fugitive complaints. We have an agreement with the other 49 states of this union that when we catch one other people that's a fugitive, that's facing charges in another state, we're going to ship them back. But often that becomes a complicated process, requiring us to file what is known as a fugitive complaint. If they object to extradition, it requires us to obtain a senator's or a governor's warrant from the requesting state, which requires us to contact the governor's office here in Oregon as the sending state. They discuss the matter. This process can take up to 90 days. Every fugitive complaint ultimately is dismissed. It's all initiated by my office in Multnomah County, if we're doing it in Multnomah County. I fear that this administrative of justice piece would face all of a sudden the ability to set aside under the law if we allowed the expansive language currently listed in 497. So I sat with Mr. Bastos yesterday over the phone, and I think we've hashed out better language to address this, more narrow language that will not allow creep, not allow sweep of other things that should never be set aside without a large discussion amongst all partners. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? So just for the record, what I'm going to take away from this is what we're really looking at trying to do is what I guess the term of art, where there's a citation in lieu of arrest. Those will now be captured with a carve-out that, if, let's say, in the contempt, if they actually gave them a citation to appear, they would still be excluded from the this process.
Chair Brzezinski, that's correct. And we're it's even a little more confined than that. The district attorney from Clatsop County, Josh Marquis, was concerned that traffic violations would fall under this.
Right.
So we're going to use some specific language about that non-traffic violations are going to be eligible. We're not going to touch traffic violations at this point. Mr. Bastos thinks that there is already protection in the statute. He's probably right. But I want to make certain Mr. Marquis' voice is heard on this matter, as well as he is a person that does like to make certain these issues get addressed. So we're going to address those very specifically, and we hope to have something for you very soon.
That sounds good. Any comments? All right. So, gentlemen, if you will step back, and Gail, if you'll stay at the table, please. And I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 497. We'll open up our last public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 493. Whitney, is this one yours?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 493 would expand the crime of assault in the fourth degree to include causing serious physical injury to a vulnerable user of a public way by means of a motor vehicle while acting with criminal negligence. This would be an A misdemeanor, and we will likely be working on an amendment in the future to provide some additional clarification.
All right. So, Tim and Kevin, you're scheduled to testify as they're coming up. Is there anyone else who will want to be testifying on Senate Bill 493? All right. So, I'm not sure.
between Kevin and Tim, who wants to go first?
I'll let Tim go first.
All right. Good morning, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. I'm Tim Colahan, Executive Director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association, appearing in support of Senate Bill 493. We see this bill as addressing a gap in the existing law and will allow these types of cases to be prosecuted as a Class A misdemeanor, which most importantly will allow for victim services to be provided to the victims of these cases, both through district attorneys as well as through the state state compensation of victims programs. The other thing I just want to point out about this bill is that this creates a Class A misdemeanor, so it will not have an impact on State Department of Corrections in any way. And I'd be we'll be happy to help with this bill, and if you have any questions, be happy to answer.
All right. Thank you. Kevin?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to join Mr. Colahan and the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of the bill. I would echo what Mr. Colahan mentioned. The access to victim services is very important. Obviously, these situations can be extremely tragic. It's a violation now. Depending on the circumstances, there is the ability to, you know, look at this by a case on a case-by-case basis, but it doesn't have the impact on prisons that a felony would have. So the a misdemeanor, we believe, is an appropriate place to set this penalty. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to be brief today. That's our reason for support.
All right. Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill, and we want to say that to the chair, we recognize that this is a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony proposal, and that reduces our anxiety quite a bit. I wanted to put something on the record that is a conversation I had with the chair yesterday. There is existing in the assault force statute. It is by default a misdemeanor, but there are circumstances listed in the ORS that elevate it to a felony under different circumstances, and those are primarily written with the idea of a domestic violence type assault. And I don't want to put words in the chair's mouth, but I had a discussion. Is it the intention of the proponents of the bill to have those factors elevate a vehicular incident to a felony in the event that one of those four factors was present, most particularly the assault was observed by a minor child of the defendant or the victim? It's my understanding that the proponents do not intend to have those factors apply, but we would ask the committee to be clear about that, and hopefully also the bill on its face to be clear about that.
All right, and let me just go ahead and follow up on that. If you look at the statute, the current statute, I think it's 1A and B are the ones that seem to deal more with the domestic violence. So what we'll have is, and the new portion of the bill or the statute, which is in the bill, will be sub C. So we will carve out that sub C does not have the increasers that are there for, as Gail Myers has said, for those situations that are really predominantly in the domestic violence assault cases. So that will clarify that, because clearly, and speaking to others, there's never the intent when the bill came before us last time to capture that type of a sanction where, say, a child was on the side of the road and there was this accident that caused the serious injury to a vulnerable user of the roadway, be it a construction worker, trooper, cyclist, pedestrian, or whoever that's covered by that statute. So that will be incorporated into it. Questions? Okay. So, let's see. First, I got Senator Denbrough and then Senator Thatcher.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, actually, you may have answered my question, Chair, but I'm just wondering, Tim or Kevin, if you could give me an example of where this offense would apply, and how it's handled now under current current law.
Thank you for the question, Chair Przanski, Senator Denbrough. In fact, I can give you two examples of cases. We made an inquiry of district attorneys around the state, and two cases, one out of Morrow County, one out of Wasco County. First one out of Morrow County, a state police officer was responding to an accident and was parked alongside the road and was walking along the side of the road toward the accident to put out flares and safety measures. And a semi-truck came around the corner and struck him and his vehicle and seriously injured him. The other case was out of Morrow County, and it was a truck driver who was stopped alongside the road in a construction area, which was clearly marked. Line of traffic was going by. The truck driver was tightening down the straps on his load, and a car just started veering off out of the lane of travel and hit the truck driver, severely injuring his legs. The problem with the statutes right now is that we have to prosecute them. In order to get them to a crime, we have to prove reckless conduct. And reckless conduct, usually we're dealing with situations where there's alcohol on board, controlled substances, or excessive speed, evidence of reckless behavior. And in the two cases I just told you about, and there's others, none of those factors were present. So it becomes very difficult for the state to prove reckless conduct. But criminal negligence is a lower standard and is easier to prove and applies better in those circumstances.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up. Mm-hmm. That really helps, Tim. And what if the subsequent investigation suggested that the individual was texting or on their cell phone while this happened, which I can imagine is a frequent occurrence in mm-hmm. these cases?
Senator Przanski, Senator Denbrough, I think that would be one factor that would be looked at to see whether or not this would be a situation where distracted driving would apply. It's one of the factors that demonstrates the problem showing reckless behavior as opposed to criminal negligence. Many times it's also just inattentive behavior where a driver is drowsy and just leaves the lane of travel.
Senator Thatcher?
Well, thank you. You were talking a little bit about reckless versus criminal negligence, and criminal negligence is a lower state of mind that you can prove. So that's kind of where I'm hung up, because I feel like if you explain, maybe you can explain it to me, but I see it as a failure to know that, and I'm just trying to go by memory here, and I'm not an attorney, so basically that one's actions would result in somebody getting seriously injured. Going back to Portland, driving in Portland, and there's bicycles like bees coming from everywhere, is just knowing that there are bicyclists coming like bees everywhere, knowledge enough to know that if you turn right and one appears right there and you hit them, that would maybe be considered criminal negligence?
Sure. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher. I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but the difference between reckless behavior and criminal negligence, reckless behavior requires that the person be aware of and consciously disregard a substantial risk, where criminal negligence requires that the person fails to be aware of that substantial risk. So that's the difference. The problem with showing reckless is the state has to prove that the person was aware of and consciously disregards that. And in cases where it's a distracted driver, no alcohol, no reckless behavior, no other type of controlled substance, it's difficult to show that level of consciousness, that they were aware of the risk and they consciously disregard it. Criminal negligence just shows that the person was completely failure to be aware of it and acted. Each case is going to stand on its own merits, and all of those factors, including the ones that you just talked about as far as bicyclists, are going to be reviewed. And these are difficult cases, but under existing law, it's very difficult for these cases to be prosecuted and provide services to the victims.
So let me give you another example using the bicycle. I mean, if someone's buzzing in and out of traffic on a bicycle,
that's definitely going to be a factor that the prosecutor is going to be looking at as to their conduct and how and what they did, because it's one of those things, from my perspective, would be very hard to anticipate exactly someone moving in your way. As a contrary to that, if you're driving down the road and you actually literally pass a cyclist going on a bike lane in the same direction, I think a case could be made that if you made a turn in front of that vehicle and didn't signal your turn or those type of scenarios, those are going to be factors that we'll be taking in, because you would think, I mean, I guess I would say a driver should be aware of their surroundings. They've just passed somebody that's in a designated lane, and all of a sudden they're making this turn in front of them. That awareness of, you know, the perception of how long it takes for that vehicle to make the turn, and at the same time, the other vehicle, in this case being a bicycle, going up and through that intersection at the same time. So those are all going to be factors that the prosecutor is going to be looking at. He or she are going to have to make a decision, as Tim said, on a case-by-case basis, as to whether even criminal negligence is there.
And I had a follow-up on.
Yes.
Oh, okay. You were talking about, excuse me, Tim, you were talking about victim services, mm-hmm. and access to victim services. Could you explain what that means? The reason I'm asking that is I was wondering if there was a civil way to go through making a civil issue of it rather than a criminal issue. In going that direction, but it sounds like victim services would not be available if a person were to be pursued civilly. Is that the difference here?
Senator Przanski, Senator Thatcher, that is partially correct. The problem presently is that unless there is a crime that is filed and prosecuted, those victims are not eligible for victim services, either through the DA's office or through the state victims compensation program. There has to be a crime. If it's only a violation, if it's a careless driving or failure to maintain single lane of travel, those are violations and the victims do not qualify for services.
Senator Lithicum.
Thank you for that distinction. It's interesting to the desire to bump this to criminal act for victim services on the one hand, and I also share some concern about the recklessly, knowingly, intentionally, you know, higher bars that the prosecution would have to go through. I'm curious, with regard to those things, we're way down at the lowest level in terms of criminal negligence, and but that includes recklessly being unaware, if I understand your language. And the subsection that I heard Ms. Meyer refer to was where those get bumped up. And assault is immediate presence or witness by the person or the victim's minor if my 16-year-old was in the front seat with me when a bicyclist in a bicycle lane who didn't see the dark gray recycle can in the middle of the lane, you know, on trash night, swerves, and I am aware, and I see his bright twinkling lights as he comes into my lane, and I still strike. There's danger there, and I don't see any avenues for mitigating that tragic scenario. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Thank you, Senator Przanski, Senator Lithicum. My understanding is that the factors that would elevate assault in the fourth degree for the domestic violence situations occurring in the presence of a child or the same victim being assaulted again, which elevates it now to a Class A or a Class C felony, would not apply under the circumstances of this bill. So in other words, you would not have a Class C felony if a person under this new statute would cause serious physical injury with a motor vehicle with criminal negligence. Those factors would not elevate.
All right.
And are those specifically carved out?
At this time, it's not clear in the bill as it reads whether or not they are, but I think it could, obviously, the legislative intent would show that.
Right. your example in the sense of if a cyclist takes a divertive move to not hit the trash can, I mean, from my perspective as a prosecutor, if that's all written in the report, you're going to be looking at it and take in consideration what is going on at that moment in time as to whether or not there should be some type of liability on the part of the driver of the car as compared to what's going on. Those things are going to be measured. It's unfortunate to say sometimes it's just an accident.
Right.
I mean, it just is what it is. And those things, you know, it's going to be, again, one of those judgment calls with all the variables being on the table. And whether two different individuals that are reviewing that case are going to come up with the same conclusion, I can't tell you that, and Tim couldn't tell you that. Go ahead.
Follow up. I think the accident phrase that you use is what's in the heart of my mind. It was a tragic circumstance and accident, and what you described in terms of the prosecutorial team, there's some balance. 30% of the accident was caused by the actions of the bicyclist and 70% by the motorist or vice versa. There's some weighing going on there that I think the criminal the criminal negligence side doesn't allow that appropriate weighting of actions taken by other actors.
Let me respond to that. I understand what you're saying is comparison on a comparative negligence on the civil side, that they assign maybe a value of how much they think someone's negligent or their actions were a partial cause of the accident. But I would disagree that the individual prosecutor is not going to be weighing all of those factors, the variables, because you still have to go into court and be able to prove that offense. And you have a standard that you have to meet. And so that is where, unfortunately, there are times where, even in my practice as a prosecutor, I have to just tell the individual, I'm sorry, I have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, or, you know, as compared to a simple preponderance of the evidence, and I just can't do that. In my world, I have to have all six jurors come back with a guilty verdict to actually get that conviction. And so I have to do those balancing weighings, and that's just part of this how the system's set up, and that's why prosecutors actually have that discretion to go forward or not. Same thing with an officer, actually, whether or not they're going to even cite someone into court for an offense. And that's the parts that we have is compared to black and white. And there's a lot of gray.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Lithicum, I think that's a good point. I mean, from an officer perspective, and we see this a lot, you see someone crossing a street out of a crosswalk wearing dark clothes in the middle of the night, right? The officer in that scene, it's a tragic scene. There's just no way of getting around it if a car hits somebody in that situation. But the officer is weighing that, and oftentimes the officer will not issue a citation based on the circumstances of what's going on at that point. So I think that's true. You know, the law is designed to be clear. The incidences often are not. And I think that the law does allow the discretion at both levels to, you know, so that there's some reason applied to this, which I think is your point.
If I might be heard, Chair Brzezinski, 2 points. In acknowledging the slide here between recklessness, well, innocent mistake, accident, reckless negligence, and then recklessness, generally in most cases, the crime is more concrete. I mean, whether the crime happened or not is a little bit more concrete. Did you steal somebody's money? Did you bash your finger, you know, hands through their windshield? Did you hurt them with a pool cue? There's more concreteness. This is a little bit of a slide. So I just wanted to say on the record, from the vantage point of the defense, there's a bit of a concern from what I heard Mr. Callahan say. We would hate to see the DA make their charging decision based on whether or not they felt the victim was in need of victim services.
Exactly.
This is a crime or this isn't a crime, and we wouldn't want victim concern for services to drive the elevator from the accident up into negligent land. That's number one. Number two, Senator Lithicum, with respect to your concern of contributory negligence, it is actually a pretty big deal that you cannot, on the criminal side, do that weighing that is done on the civil side. On the civil side, if the vulnerable road user was 40% responsible for the accident, but the defendant, let's say the driver of the motor vehicle, were 60% responsible, they would still be at fault. But when it came to damages, you would reduce the plaintiff's damages by 40% because the jury is asked, make this determination in your jury finding, and then we will pull out those damages from restitution. The criminal side is not set up to do that at all. They have to prove that the driver of the vehicle caused the accident, caused the injury. So you would think it's at least a 51% responsibility. But when it comes to restitution, there is going to be no reduction. Our laws just aren't set up for that. So that's the tension in having a negligence standard in the criminal law. There's that part of it that doesn't quite equal the civil side.
Okay, Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great conversation, but I'm a little bit confused now. We are talking about SB 493, right? Is that where we are?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so when I look at this, you know, we're talking a lot about potential automobile accidents or whatever it's caused, and you know, officers and stuff who may or may not get struck, you know, in a line of duty by a vehicle here. The bill that I'm looking at seems to be about domestic violence. What happened here? What did I miss?
You didn't miss anything. So when you look at the bill, the stuff that's in the regular print is what existing law is. An assault for, unfortunately, many of the cases that we see are focused on are the result of domestic violence. So when we put the I don't have it open in front of me. Tim probably does. But it actually has what are the elements for being able to charge the assault as a fourth degree. And then what we also have done in the legislature, knowing that domestic violence is a very serious situation and it does have repetitiveness to it, that we want to ensure that those individuals that are continuing in that type of conduct can be held to a higher standard in the sense of sanctions in the future. And so when you get down to, I think it's sub 2,
yes,
it talks about what the penalty is for just a straight assault for. But if you've been convicted previously of assaulting the same victim, or if you do the assault in front of a child, it is enhanced to a felony. So I'll let Tim fill in the blanks that I missed.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Manning, that's correct. The Senate bill that we're talking about, 493, would only address the circumstance where somebody is seriously injured by a motor vehicle, that they are a vulnerable user of the roadway, and it causes serious physical injury. The rest of the bill the rest of the language in the bill is not being amended as far as the domestic violence. It only deals with the use of a motor vehicle.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you all very much. And I'll ask once again, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 493? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 493. So that concludes the work that we have for today. Tomorrow, I just want to give a reminder for those who are going to be able to attend the What Works in Public Safety Criminal Justice Commission. This is the our CJC has been is putting this on. I believe it's the third annual one that's going to be over at the Convention Center. They do have registration and Continental Breakfast open at 8 o'clock. The gavel for the committee that we are participating in is at 9 o'clock. So if you are going to be attending, I ask that you be there, try to get there at least a 10-tail, a quarter-tail, so we can make certain where you're going to be seated. This is being well attended. They've shut down the
registration. They have, I believe, close to 1,000 people that throughout the state that are coming in. I had the opportunity to go last night to a speaker's dinner, and I know we have speakers that are coming as far away as New York City, and so that event is going on today as well as tomorrow. So if you have time and you want to see some of the other breakouts and speakers, that is going on as we speak. And then tomorrow morning is the part that we've been requested to attend. So questions and comments?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a little calendar conflict. Joint Ways and Means is convened at that time. I'll talk with the chairs and stuff and see if, since I'm going to be with them later on that evening, and then the next day if they really need me to be there.
Yeah, if you have the opportunity, I think it would just be an experience that gives you kind of the perspective of how Oregon is actually a leader in the areas and what we've done, and then some of the breakout speakers will on tomorrow morning will actually be talking about specific programs here within the state, so it may help you in your work here at the legislature. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn, but just as a reminder, we'll be meeting here in the room on Monday, and we're scheduled to start at 8:30. And again, we'll be on the 8 o'clock start Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at this point. So with that, we're adjourned.